Hey everyone, Kara here, and I just want to dive right in by thanking iAmBio for their support of the show. Where do biology, politics, patients, and our planet all intersect? We'll find out by listening to the iAmBio podcast. It's hosted by Dr. Michelle McMurray-Heath, President and CEO of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. iAmBio brings you powerful stories of biotech breakthroughs. You can discover the biggest threats to our planet's water supply, new vaccine technologies, the latest Alzheimer's research findings, and more. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 9th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is because I rely on the support of listeners just like you. So if you want to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. This week's top supporters include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so much from the very, very bottom of my heart. Not only I, but all of the people who work together to make Talk Nerdy happen, and all of the listeners out there, we really do thank you. There are other ways to support the show. You can always visit the website and shop in the Talk Nerdy store. You can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you download your shows. And of course, you can share about it on social media and get other people excited about the show. You know, what I'm excited about is today's episode, because I had the opportunity to chat with Jessica Nordell. She's actually an award-winning author, science writer, and speaker. She has written for, you know, so many great outlets, The Atlantic, The New York Times, The New Republic, and she has a new book. It's called The End of Bias, A Beginning, The Science and Practice of Overcoming Unconscious Bias. And this book was shortlisted for the 2022 Columbia Journalism Lucas Prize for Excellence in Nonfiction, the 2022 NYPL Bernstein Book Award for Excellence in Journalism, and the 2021 Royal Society Science Book Prize. She's been reporting on this topic for 15 years. And this is, you know, it all came together in this book. It's absolutely wonderful. It was named a best book of the year by AARP and Greater Good and the World Economic Forum. And it really, really is an important piece of work. One thing that I love is that as I was researching Jessica, and I found, I don't think we talk about this in the show, but I found on her bio online that not only has she won like the Gracie Award from American Women in Radio and Television and, you know, a bunch of just so many great awards, she is a direct descendant of the last woman to be tried for witchcraft in the state of Massachusetts. I love that that's included in your bio, Jessica. You're amazing. She's also an amateur rock drummer. Who knew? So the author of The End of Bias, without any further ado, here she is, Jessica Nordell. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I have to say, when I saw your book, I immediately was like, we have to have this conversation. This is so important. It's a topic that very often on the show is discussed, but is never the center of the conversation, I would say. And so I'm thrilled to be talking about unconscious bias. But even before we talk about unconscious bias, I want to talk a little bit about you, because this is your first book, isn't it?
That's right.
Okay, so how did we get here? This is kind of the culmination of research and writing on this topic for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, let me think, how far back do we want to go?
Right.
I started really thinking about and writing about this topic in like the mid 2000s. So it's been about 15 years since I really got very kind of deeply invested in the topic. And my own interest came out of personal experiences that I had had with gender bias at work. And those experiences prompted me to start investigating this phenomenon in kind of a more systematic way. And so I started writing about it and reporting and researching and interviewing scientists and, you know, social scientists. And the book came about because after, you know, many years of reporting and writing about it, I started to get a little impatient with just talking about the problem. You know, in journalism, yeah, we really focus on uncovering problems. And it can, I think, leave many of us feeling like, okay, but what do we actually do, you know, about this? Yeah. Like, we've identified it. So the book really came about because I wanted to figure out what we do about this. And so the angle that I take with the book is, you know, we understand that this is a serious problem. And I spent some time in this project kind of demonstrating how serious the problem is, but then really focused on approaches that have been shown to actually change people's behavior and change organizations, how organizations function and change cultures. So that's kind of in, you know, short form how the book came about. It was really my attempt to try to move the conversation forward into how do we actually solve this problem of bias and discrimination.
Oh, it's such an important topic. And so the work that you have been doing as a journalist, how did you sort of make that transition? Because I know that you also had been in academia, you moved into journalism, and sort of like, how did you make that transition from the subjects that you studied to focusing on the areas where you do your reporting?
Interesting. So my background is physics. That's what I studied in college. And in graduate school, I studied poetry. So I have this kind of weird, somewhat eclectic,
I love that. Yeah.
academic, you know, background. I was really interested in science, and I'm a geek, and I'm, you know, really interested in how things work and kind of like getting to the fundamentals and understanding, you know, sort of the basic forces that drive the world as we know it. But I've also always really been interested in language and storytelling and kind of putting those two things together. So for me, science writing and science journalism was kind of a natural way to blend these two fascinations of mine.
Oh, it's amazing. And so, like we mentioned, you've written about unconscious bias for a bunch of different outlets so far. But then, mm-hmm. of course, you brought this reporting together and obviously dug deeper to do like a full length book. And it's a solution focused book. But first, we probably should define the problem. Mm-hmm. So tell us, for those who maybe kind of think they know, or they're like, I kind of get what unconscious bias is, but I'm not really sure if I could repeat it to you. How do you define unconscious bias?
Yeah, you know, it sounds like a simple question, but it's kind of like a contested idea even in, mm-hmm. in the social, you know, in the research community now. But what, you know, the way that I think of it is unconscious bias, or what I've kind of come to call unexamined bias or unintentional bias.
Yeah.
Is what happens when people hold egalitarian values and they want to treat people fairly, and they truly, you know, they truly value equality. They truly value treating people with a sense of fairness and justice. But because we live in a culture that feeds us toxic messages constantly about all sorts of social groups, these same people, many of us who hold egalitarian values, can behave in ways that conflict with those values. And, you know, I'd be happy to talk about kind of the mechanics of how that works, but the result is that many of us, and I include myself in this, can be susceptible to behaving in ways that are not in line with how we really want to be, how we really want to treat people. And that is off, you know, it's kind of an unexamined reaction, which can be in the form of how we judge another person, or how we behave, or how we speak to another person, how we feel. All of these different kinds of reactions can happen spontaneously and automatically and not be really in line with how we want to be in the world.
Right. It's kind of like when people, progressive people, I myself would say I do this all the time and I speak about it all the time, but it tends to confuse some people who aren't as politically aligned with me. When I say things like I'm anti-racist, but I'm still racist, like I try not to be, but it's I'm socialized to be racist, or I am still sexist, even though I am a woman, because I've been socialized to believe and think certain things that aren't, that require deeper examination. So all of us perpetuate these systemic, these institutional problems through, as you mentioned, these unexamined biases. So, you know, is the first step really just to make them conscious, to take them from the unconscious to the conscious? Or is there something we should be doing even before that?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the fact that you can be sexist even as a woman, because I feel like that's actually something that people often have a really hard time with, that idea. And I talk about it too, you know, like recognizing kind of the ways that I've inherited toxic lies about women from, you know, my entire life.
Right. From everywhere, from our parents, from the media, from every other person we've ever encountered. I mean, it's like, how can you not?
You know, anytime you're in a group with people of different genders, all you have to do is watch the group dynamics to see the ways that, you know, women are, you know, take a back seat often, in terms of, you know, who's interrupted, who's listened to, all of this. So yeah, it's everywhere. As you say, it's everywhere.
Oh, you see it when people have baby. Like I, you know, I'm of that age. I'm in my late 30s. And so, you know, of the sort of lefty group of people who tend to not have babies until they're in their 30s. And so all of my friends are like having little kids now. And you notice even amongst very, very progressive people who, you know, try really hard, you still see that the little boy babies by, and very often it's by their friends, family, you know, whatever. Oh, you're so strong. Look how strong you are. And the little boy, girl babies. Oh, look how sweet. Oh, you're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And like, you're getting these messages from before you even understand language. Like, how could you not be affected by them?
Yes. Yes. And then, you know, as a child who wants to, you know, please those around him or her in order to, you know, stay alive and survive. You know, the child starts to absorb those messages and then behave in a way that, you know, that fulfills the expectations and desires of the adults around them. Yeah. So it starts at a really young and, you know, as you say, pre-verbal age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it becomes something that, like we mentioned, we all internalize. And I love how you, when you were first defining it, you made the distinction between the values and the sort of interests that somebody holds dear to them, you know, really their identity, their political identity, their ideology, is sometimes in conflict with our thoughts and our actions. And that's really what this whole quote unconscious or implicit, sometimes you'll hear it referred to, side of the bias is. It happens sort of before we've even had time to examine it.
Exactly. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think that's what is so challenging often for people to even recognize what's happening, because it happens so quickly. I mean, you know, I've been writing about this and thinking about this for a long time, and I still, you know, I still notice this kind of spontaneous reaction that I have often in a social situation, or even if I'm kind of thinking about a situation, the sort of spontaneous judgment that I have can happen so quickly that if you're not really attuned to it or not really prepared to investigate it, it can go completely unnoticed, which is one of the reasons that it's so insidious, I think, because it can be so often not noticed by the person who's actually doing it.
And I often see that there are different outcomes of this. There are those who have sort of started to do the work, and you know, that could either mean that they're like in therapy or that they're reading about these topics, or they're starting to examine themselves a little bit more. And I think one of the hardest things to do is to sort of admit, yes, I am racist, even though I don't want to be, because I grew up in a racist society. Or yes, I am sexist, even though I don't want to be, because I grew up in a sexist society and I've internalized a lot of these beliefs. And so, like, I want to affect change. But sadly, there are a lot of people for whom that idea is very threatening because they're not quite there yet with their thoughts about, you know, this idea, I'm trying to put it into good words, and I'm thinking about people in my own family, you know, having grown up in Texas, very often I'll have conversations with people in my family who are not as politically aligned with me and say, okay, but that's a very racist ideal. And they'll be like, I am not racist. Like it's like more offensive to them than anything else. And I'm like, no, but everybody is. Like we all are. Like we gotta get outside of this. So what do we do when the idea of having implicit bias is so threatening that people reject the concept outright?
I mean, it's a real challenge. I think you're absolutely right. One of the things that happens is that when people hear something like, oh, you know, what you've just said is, you know, it's biased, or it, you know, there are racist elements of what you just said or sexist elements of what you just said, I think it triggers almost this fight or flight response in some people, because it feels like a questioning of a person's essential goodness. You know, we all want to feel that we are good people at heart. And when someone hears that they embody these harmful ideas, or let me restate that. I think when people hear that they are acting in these harmful ways, it almost feels like an existential threat to their sense of themselves as a good person. And so, I mean, I think one of the things that we have to do is normalize the idea that this is in our culture, and this, you know, these ideas are toxic inheritances that we've received for, in the case of racism, hundreds of years, in the case of sexism, thousands of years. I mean, the patriarchy predates the written record. Like, it's really old, the idea that, you know, men are superior to women.
So, yeah, for all intents and purposes, I mean, for all that we know from an anthropological kind of standing, for all that we know, it's only ever been that way. Like, there's kind of not that many examples of an alternative to the patriarchy.
Well, the good news, there are actually some really interesting examples in pockets around the world where you see more sort of complementarity, or you see examples of women and men being, you know, women being valued in ways that they are not today, or, you know, they're
not. But isn't it funny that even in those pocketed examples, it's like, women are maybe viewed as equal or separate, but equal, you know, but there's still no, I think it's a myth that there are these comic book examples of like matriarchal society, like societies where like women ruled and like made all the decisions and were like seen as the stronger sex. And yeah, that's not a thing, sadly.
Yeah. I think what is kind of, promising, though, is that there are cultures, like if you look at the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, or otherwise known as the Iroquois Confederacy, pre-contact with Europeans, there was a lot more complementarity. And so, you know, women in the Haudenosaunee Confederacy had the power to declare war. They had the power to elect chiefs, to depose chiefs. Like, they were extremely powerful.
Yeah, politically. That's really...
Politically. That's, and they huge. Were really seen as being... They were seen as being absolutely, you know, essential equal partners in the society, to the extent that when there were meetings between European, you know, treaty makers and Haudenosaunee, you know, representatives, the Haudenosaunee would bring women to these meetings, and the Europeans they were frustrated and bewildered that women were there. You know, and we have records. I actually talk about some of this in my book. Like, we have records of, you know, letters where the European representative from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, for instance, says, you know, we understand that you want to bring women to these meetings, but we can't figure out why, and we would really request that you leave them at home.
Jesus. Wow. And of course, they're like, what are you even talking about?
Right, right.
Like, and then the response like, she's like our town, you know, she like is the person in charge of X, Y, and Z. Of course she needs to be here.
Exactly. That's exactly the response. Like, of course, why would we not bring women? Like, they're an essential part of, you know, our entire society.
Oh, man. And so it's like, you know, again, reinforcing what we've already been saying. Of course, people have these internalized views because, of course, our society has been founded on these, what's even the word I'm looking for? Ideas, values,
hierarchies.
Hierarchies and like misconceptions, misperceptions about, you know, capabilities and about value of individual lives and, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so this is there is this conversation that has to be had of like, whether you believe it or not, trust me, the evidence is there. You know, there's a ton of evidence to support the fact that this does exist, that this is pernicious. But it must still be an uphill battle, you know, for somebody like you who's really focused in a laser pointer way on this topic, how often you must approach people who are like, well, that's not even real. So why are you writing about it?
You know, what's so interesting, Kara, is some of the sort of skeptical responses that I've gotten haven't been so much about whether this is a problem, but whether it's a problem for an individual. So I've talked to folks that, you know, are progressive, you know, self-identified sort of progressive, kind of lefty folks whose response to this subject is like, well, I know this is a really big problem in society. It's a huge problem, but it doesn't really apply to me, you know. A couple of folks have said, you know, this doesn't really apply to me because I grew up in Berkeley.
Yeah, there's no racism in Berkeley. Come on.
So I think, you know, I think for so many people, you know, even people who are maybe like politically really kind of on board with the fact that this is a problem and the fact that we, you know, it needs to be addressed, still have a hard time seeing the way that it lives in their own hearts and minds.
Right. They're like, I'm on the coast. This is definitely like a flyover state problem. Like, it's right. So gross. It's weird that you almost see this like bimodal problem where people on the far right or people on the far left, or you can't even really like say it that way. Just there are people from every walk of life who struggle to accept something kind of dark about themselves, because like you mentioned before, and maybe that right there is a fundamental problem, we see this not as a reality of growing up in a society with very specific pressures, but we see it as some sort of internal wrong. We see it as a moral failure. And I think that framing it that way is never going to lead to overcoming.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I think we have to shift from seeing it as like a moral, you know, harboring these stereotypes in our minds. We have to shift from seeing it as a moral failure to like a predictable consequence of living in a culture that has, you know, that where we're swimming in these messages. But I think the really good news that I really want to bring to, you know, your listeners and to readers of the book is that there are so many things that we can do to combat this and to create a better world, a better culture, better relationships, you know, stronger communities, and that the benefit is not only to, you know, the society that we live in, but also actually to the people who are combating their own biases. You know, there's a huge amount to gain by looking inside and really working on these things, because it totally transforms your relationships to other people when you do so.
Yeah. And it seems like there's almost, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's almost an important, maybe distinction, maybe that's not the right word, but it's important to recognize that this is an individual problem, but it's also a systemic problem. And I would assume that the kind of solutions or even the steps toward being solution oriented aren't exactly the same for the individual as they are for the institution.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so how do we approach that? You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, I strive to be anti-racist. I yes. strive to be anti-sexist. And part of that is recognizing my own, bias and working to bring it out into the light and to grapple with it and, you know, and challenge it. It's another thing to say, that is a toxic workplace. I don't want to be there because I'm uncomfortable yeah. as a woman.
Yes, absolutely. And that, I mean, I this is a question that I actually get a lot from folks is like, well, what do I do if I am in a workplace where this is a constant problem? And people aren't, you know, making the individual or structural or, you know, organizational wide changes that need to happen. And, you know, and I, in that case, you know, my answer is always, well, you have to sort of assess to you know, the extent to which this is fixable. And if it's not, if the problem is too entrenched and not fixable, then I think it is better to get out and go somewhere where you are appreciated and where you can thrive. But this question of like the individual versus the structural is so interesting, Kara, because, you know, when I was working on this book in the early stages, I was looking at both. I was looking at individual approaches that change individuals and organizational approaches that change organizations and kind of broader interventions and you know, studies that have shown changes in culture. And at one point, I was really questioning whether I should even focus on the individual because, as you point out, like there are so many ways that these ideas and these problems are perpetuated at a policy level, at a structural level, at these like much bigger macro scales.
Not only does it make us feel hopeless, but it makes us feel like, I don't know, it's hard to want to try. It's hard to want to change if you feel like you're the David in the situation.
I personally went through that experience myself. I mean, partway through this book, I remember like I had this dark night of the soul where I literally woke up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my gosh, it's the structures. It's the structures. Like, why am I focusing on individuals at all? You know, maybe I should, I don't even know what I'm, you know, why I'm focusing on this. And then I remember thinking to myself, it's that we have to change the structures. We have to burn down some of these, you know, larger policy problems and, you know, structural problems. And then my next thought was, but we can't burn ourselves down. And we're the one, I mean, these structures don't come out of nowhere. Laws don't come out of nowhere. Policies don't come out of nowhere. It's people that create them and uphold them and enforce them. So ultimately, we do have to work on the individual because that's where it all starts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the big kind of conundrum comes from the fact that the people who have the most skin in the game, because they are the ones who are on the receiving end, the people who are often the victims and the experiencers of unconscious bias are very often the ones who are most aware of it and are the ones who are striving to change. But the perpetuators are very often either the ones who haven't done the work and don't really recognize it or are so entrenched that they intentionally perpetuate it, you know, that they actually harbor explicit, conscious, you know, biases. And that becomes really hard when it's like, oh, you're a lawmaker and you are intentionally putting forward a racist policy that you know is racist because that is the goal that you are trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think that is just a fundamental kind of truth of trying to deal with inequality. You know, the people who are the most affected are going to be the ones that care the most and are often the ones with less power to actually make the change, which is why I feel like I you know, whenever I hear like older white guys say that, you know, they feel like they're being pushed aside in culture or they're, you know, there isn't room for them. The appeal that I make is no, please, there is so much for you to do. There are so many ways that you can join these efforts to create a more fair society, please join us. Like, you know, there's, I just want to kind of welcome in anyone who has, you know, some of those privileges, because there's so much opportunity for them to, you know, to support this work.
Yeah. And sadly, not just quote support it, but, probably perpetuate or affect change faster. I mean, like you said, like when people are in power, and people already kind of have that hand on the lever, and then they sort of wake up to this, it's so fast and easy. And we see examples of this all the time, where there'll be, whether it's like a television network or a print, you know, like a journal or a magazine, and sort of people do a campaign and finally bring to the attention of the, you know, the board or the chair, or somebody who's like at the very tippy top, like, look at how detrimental this reporting was, or look at how much bias there is, or, hey, we did this survey and it shows that like 95% of the people represented here are white. And they go, oh, that's not, oh God, I didn't realize, we need to make a change. And overnight they make change because they have power.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some of the stories I tell in the book of like, real change, significant change that has happened has been because people in positions of power have decided that this is really important. You know, there was like a French law firm run by an Italian CEO who realized that in his law firm, women were systematically being underpromoted, underpaid, you know, not given as many opportunities to take on really challenging assignments. And he realized that this was actually harming the law firm. It was harming the bottom line because there were all these really high potential employees who just weren't, you know, being given opportunities to do their best work. And so he like systematically discovered all the different points in the hiring process and the promotion process in, you know, distribution of assignments where women were being, you know, discriminated against. And he then systematically eliminated all those points of discrimination. And the change was rapid. It was extremely powerful. The company's revenue went up. Their client base increased because now all these high potential employees were actually able to do their work. And, you know, he was the CEO. He had a huge amount of power to make these kinds of changes, and it was really effective.
And it kind of really goes to show that once there is an interest, or once there is once an individual wants to affect change, if they are in a position of power, the tools exist, right? Like he was able, like you mentioned, to notice all of these bottlenecks and all of these points of bias and sort of make policy changes to overcome them. But the secret sauce is like, what happened to make him, quote, just realize? Like, how did he just wake up one day? And how do we do that? How do we bottle that? Because that seems to be the really difficult part of this equation.
It really is. Yeah, I love that question because you're totally right. The tools are there. This is not a problem of confusion about what needs to be done.
Right.
I give them all to you in this book. Like, you know, these are the things that can work. And yes, I think the bottleneck is often the mindset. And the mindset really needs to be, these are changes that my organization needs to make because this is going to create a better organization for everyone, for the employees, for the clients, for the customers, for everyone. Like, this is, you know, fundamentally important to the way we operate. And how we get to that understanding, you know, I think people come to it through different paths. In this particular case, I'm thinking about this French law firm. Let me think about what it was. I mean, in his case, he was put in this position as CEO, and he was tasked with turning the performance of the law firm around.
Yeah, so he already had a vested interest in affecting change somehow.
Yes. And he wasn't able to raise money to bring in more resources. So he had to turn the company around using the resources that were already there. And so for him, I think you know, it was sort of a, you know, it was sort of a process of just trying to figure out how to, like, what he could do to kind of unlock more of the potential within the resources that already existed. And as he kind of systematically went through and thought about it, he saw that it was really discrimination that was preventing that from happening.
It's interesting because you almost see that in larger culture. And of course, I'm going to have an American bias here because this is, you know, where I live and this is where I grew up learning history. But you almost see that through these pinch points of American history as well, where there is an entrenched and pernicious, you know, gender bias. But when men were taken out of the workforce because of war, women were necessarily brought into the workforce because they had to be. And only because they had to be was there a sort of recognition that, oh yeah, women have value to the workforce and we should probably be using that talent to the benefit of the global economy. You know, we see this a lot. It's sort of like sexism only works or racism only really works when it benefits the power structure. But when the power structure starts to struggle,
right,
they'll very easily abandon certain ideologies in order to, for means to an end.
Absolutely. I mean, I love that point. Like, you can see that the idea of, you know, white supremacy or male supremacy is a lie. Because exactly at the when it isn't helpful to the powers anymore, you can get rid of it. Really, you know, you can put women into positions where they can, you know, where they flourish, because that's what's important. Or, you know, in the case of race, if you look at, you know, toward the end of World War II, the U.S. Army integrated several divisions because it was important to the cause of the war. And
yeah, because they're like, oh, these people are valuable. Oh, they're actually just as good of soldiers, if not better. And of course, this way that I was always viewing, you know, Black members of society as not people, but as products. Now, all of a sudden, I have to change my viewpoint because it affects my bottom line. It's so gross, though. Ugh, I don't even like thinking about that. It's so
true.
Clear in hindsight.
And interestingly, I mean, the Army integration example is so interesting because after the U.S. Army integrated many divisions at the end of World War II, they surveyed the white officers who were working, you know, who were fighting alongside the Black service people. And they found that their attitudes completely changed. You know, their, you know, disrespect was replaced with respect and admiration because they were, you know, working and fighting side by side with their equals. And this survey that found that attitudes had changed so much was hidden for a long time. I don't know if it was actually ever published because Congress was worried that that it would let me find that. This is actually kind of an interesting little historical note. This survey that uncovered that white officers' attitudes changed so much with integration was concealed because Congress was worried that it would cause the NAACP to push for more integration.
Of course, right? If it worked here, come on, people. And I think something that kind of fundamentally, how do I put this? Bear with me as I try to organize my thoughts and make them into words that make sense. But I worry from a social justice perspective about relying too heavily on the economic argument. And we very often see this because we are a capitalist society, which, you know, I personally have moral objections to. So very often you'll see that the argument that works the best, especially in a legislative kind of setting, is no, but look at the bottom line, or look at the ROI, look at the benefit to all of us if we're more inclusive, if we're more diverse. But where that falls apart, sadly, is in situations where we truly are talking about the most vulnerable among us. And this brings me to sorry, this feels very random and left turn, but I promise I'll come back. I remember engaging with a conversation with a friend from Australia who was like really not understanding certain aspects of our bizarre political system here. And he was like, but I don't understand for-profit healthcare. And I was like, I know. And he was like, so what do you do with people that will never be able to contribute to society in a meaningful economic way because they're just too sick? And I was like, yeah, that's a great question. Have you seen the number of homelessness, you know, this number of unhoused people in our society? Have you seen, we don't have a safety net for a lot of these people. And so it that sort of speaks to this frustration that I have sometimes when we talk about diversity and inclusion and egalitarianism, that it's almost like necessarily within a capitalist society, unless a person has a financial value, nobody wants to listen to an argument. And that bums me out in a really major way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what we ultimately need to understand and internalize on a deep level is the fundamental value of all beings.
Right.
Which is why I think, go ahead.
No, just, yes, I agree completely.
Right? For a little while, I thought, I was thinking about subtitling this book, The Science and Spirit of Overcoming Unconscious Bias, because I think fundamentally this is a spiritual question, which is how do we relate to one another in a way that is suffused with care, respect, and love, fundamentally.
Yeah, and I mean, how do we even get people to want that? I think that's the part that's so frustrating, and I hate to perseverate on problems and not solutions again, but don't you ever just feel like you're screaming into the void?
You know, I don't, and I'll tell you why.
Good. Yes, please inspire me.
Yes. I have met since this book it's been out for several months now, since it's come out, I have heard from so many people who are looking for ways to expand and grow and connect with others in new ways and are really looking for tools to help them do that. Whether it's, you know, elderly white people from the South, you know, or people in tech startups who are trying to figure out how to help their employees be able to feel like, you know, they can do their jobs without being hindered by bias, or whether it's, you know, folks who are trying to figure out how to make AI more fair and inclusive. There are so many people that are actually really trying to do better and create, you know, a better path forward, that I don't feel like I'm screaming into the void, because I'm hearing from so many people who are on board, you know, who really want to, who want to figure out a better way to be. So I share that with you as a as a little injection of optimism.
I so appreciate that. And given that, I mean, I think that sort of leads us to an important question and a really important focus of your book, which is, as we mentioned before, it's not that we don't have these tools. These tools do exist. And you, of course, have spent an inordinate amount of time researching evidence-based, like really looking at the literature to delineate ways that we can overcome unconscious, implicit bias. And so I was hoping that we could spend, you know, sort of the latter half of our chat today talking about, you know, news you can use, like things that we as individuals can do to affect change.
There are so many things we can do. I mean, yes, I would love to share some of those. one of the, I'm trying to think, like, which of the stories do I want to share?
Right. Where do we start?
Where do we start? You know, one of the approaches that I have been really impressed by in terms of like the data that show that it actually makes quantifiable change in people is a particular way of structuring interactions. So really briefly, in the 1950s, there was a psychologist named Gordon Allport who developed this hypothesis I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah, big deal guy. Yeah. Anybody who studied psychology should know that name.
Exactly. So Gordon Allport is seen as the progenitor of contact theory. And the idea of contact theory is that if you bring people together at equal status and you facilitate them to collaborate on a shared goal, on a common goal, and it's with the approval of an institution or an authority, that particular kind of interaction can start to break down stereotypes and prejudices that the two groups might have about one another. And this was kind of a hypothesis for a long time. And over the decades, psychologists have tried to figure out whether this actually works or whether it's just, you know, a nice idea. But
right. So kind of inclusivity for its own sake, not, I shouldn't say for its own sake, but like representation begets more egalitarian values by the very virtue of the fact that those people's voices are at the table now.
Yes. And specifically when people are working together on a shared goal, like just being sort of side by side isn't necessarily going to start to alter those attitudes. But when people are actually working collaboratively on a shared goal, some of the prejudices start to wear away. And we've seen there's a lot of evidence of examples where this actually works. Like there was a really interesting study of cricket players in India that looked at what happened when you have men of different castes on the same cricket team versus when you have homogenous cricket teams. And in this particular study, they found that when men of different castes were on the same team, so it's like this perfect contact theory situation where they're collaborating on a shared goal, they have equal status because they're teammates, and it's within like a league where this is kind of approved of and normalized, that those men, after playing many, many games, their attitudes altered about men of other castes. They were more likely to have friends of other castes, to nominate men of other castes for prizes, to want to have more connection with men of other castes. And so this is a really good example of that, actually, you know, that particular way of interacting starting to break down some of those ideas. And so the way that this, you know, if we're talking about news you could use, you know, the way that I've actually internalized this is when I'm looking, you know, when I'm sort of deciding what activities to take on or how to get involved in my community, I really look for opportunities where I'm collaborating across social differences with people on a shared goal. And I think that's something that we can all think about, you know, we can all do when we're kind of going out into the world trying to figure out, you know, if we have opportunities where we have some free time or where we have some discretionary, you know, time, look for opportunities where you're really working on a shared goal with people who are different. That's a really good start for starting to kind of break down some of those boundaries.
And that kind of works at almost every level of power, of conversation, like whether we're talking about the boardroom, where it's probably going to have a more obvious and maybe immediate effect, but all the way down to the sort of floor of whatever institution we're talking about, kind of stratifying this diverse group and this diverse group that's goal oriented is going to change the minds of the individuals that are on that team. Okay, all right. So that's a big deal, but that's also something that again, the kind of the powers that be have to have buy-in for. They have to be interested in affecting that change. So what about if you are in a position where you don't have a lot of power, but you still want to do something?
It kind of depends on whether you are looking for approaches to kind of change the self, you know, to, mm-hmm. Really examine and, you know, examine one's own biases and, start to create, you know, more positive interactions with other people. From that perspective, one approach that is really promising is mindfulness meditation. So basically practicing non-judgmental awareness of what is happening inside the body and outside the body at any moment. And one of the reasons that this can be really helpful for unintentional bias is that practice starts to help us, it helps us regulate our emotional state. And what we know about bias is that it's really exacerbated by things like stress and fatigue and cognitive load. So when you're really taxed cognitively, because you just have a lot that you're dealing with, and you those are moments when biases tend to get worse, where Right. we tend to rely more on stereotypes. So if you can start to regulate that through practices like mindfulness meditation, then those biases are much easier to override, to interrupt, and to regulate.
And of course, this would have such intense outcomes when we're looking at fight or flight type situations, when we're thinking about situations that are really fraught with fear and reactivity, like interactions with police, for example, that if the police were trained in some of these more mindfulness approaches, if the police were trained more heavily in these crisis intervention approaches, that the reactivity wouldn't be exacerbated by unconscious bias.
Absolutely. And actually I have two chapters where I look at approaches with policing specifically. And there's some really interesting research being done out in Oregon by some police departments who are actually looking at this as an intervention to improve the improve police behavior, actually. And the studies, there still need to be a lot more studies done, but some promising initial studies have shown that with consistent practice of mindfulness meditation, this decreases aggression in officers, it decreases reactivity, it improves emotional regulation, and basically starts to give police officers the resources, the internal resources, so they can show up in a more positive way, in a more balanced and respectful way with the community that they're serving.
I love that. And don't you also, you give some examples of change in academia. Like there's a very specific example that you give about a preschool, actually. So this is sort of like get them when they're young in Sweden, right? So tell me about dealing with some gender stereotyping that was recognized. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was really interesting. So I spent some time in Stockholm at a preschool that had really tackled the problem of gender stereotyping head on. And in this preschool, what happened was many years ago, there had been a directive given to the schools in Stockholm to try to create schools that where boys and girls and all genders were able to thrive. And in this particular preschool, the director thought, well, we need to figure out how the students are perhaps stereotyping each other or discriminating against each other so that we can interrupt the students' bad behavior or harmful behavior. So she and her teacher started videotaping what was happening during the day at this preschool. And to her, shock and the teacher's shock, they discovered that it was actually the teachers who were right. interacting with the students in different ways, depending on if the students were boys or girls. So they noticed that they were talking a lot more to the girl students, and they were cuddling the girl students more and giving them more leeway for crying and having emotional reactions. And they were giving the boy students more leeway in being rowdy or aggressive. So they were really treating the students differently. And so in this preschool, it was a little bit like what happened with the law firm, in that the leader said, you know what, this isn't okay anymore. We have to figure out a better way. And so she, sort of like this law firm CEO, she started examining all the different ways that boys and girls were being treated differently in this preschool. She systematically went about removing all of those points of stereotyping and discrimination. So she and the teachers decided that instead of saying hello boys and girls, they would just say hello friends. They started using the gender neutral pronoun in Swedish, which is hen. So if someone was coming in to interview for a job as a cafeteria worker, the teachers would refer to the person as hen rather than making an assumption about whether it was a man or a woman. They removed the gender from characters in the books that they were reading to children. So, or sometimes they would swap the gender. So if there was like a cute kitten, maybe they would refer to that as a boy. If there was like a mischievous fox, maybe they would refer to that character as a girl. So they started just kind of trying to mix things up and sort of loosen some of the gender stereotyping that was happening.
And I can imagine that has massive downstream effects on the children.
Yes. So what was really interesting, when some researchers came to the school to study what effect this approach had, they found that compared to students at other Swedish preschools, the students at this preschool did less gender stereotyping. They were like, when they were asked, when they were shown pictures of different students and asked who you would like to be friends with, they were less likely to choose a friend of their same gender. They were less likely to assume what kinds of toys different students would play with according to their perceived gender. So they actually did less gender stereotyping when gender was less emphasized, when it was really kind of downplayed in the school culture over a period of time.
I love that, because not only does this lead to an environment in which the sort of gender stereotyping, as we know, tends to be it's not unilateral, but like it follows the values of the culture, which very often, as we know, in like modern Western society means men powerful, women second class. And so not only does it start to dissolve some of those misogynistic gender stereotypes, but it also challenges the sort of cisgender binary. So now there's inclusivity when we're discussing gender nonconforming individuals, when we're discussing transgender individuals, and less just a kind of immediate bias, because there's an openness to gender that maybe didn't exist before. So it's got all of these positive downstream effects for individuals that don't necessarily fit the sort of normalized gender bias that has been sadly kind of the norm for so long in many societies.
Absolutely. And that was something else that it was really interesting talking to the teachers at this school about, because they said that, students, boys would wear, play dress up with skirts, and that is completely, normalized and accepted in this school. And one thing that was so interesting was the teachers saw how much they had been relying on gender to interact with students, because they would, when a student arrives whose gender isn't immediately identifiable as either, you know, a boy or a girl, they said they could feel their brains kind of craving that information. Like it was, they could feel that urge to categorize, to figure out, is this a boy or is this a girl? And then because the school culture, discourages them from pursuing that, or for treating a child in a particular way, depending on their perceived gender, that allowed them to actually see the way their brain was kind of craving that information. And just, you know, how entrenched this idea of the gender binary is. You know, it's important to note that that transgender people, or people who have not fit into a binary, have always been present in human history, in human culture. Every, you know, culture around the world has had folks who don't belong to exclusively a male or exclusively a female category. So you're right. I think by de-emphasizing the primacy of gender, like this preschool does, it allows more space for the full spectrum of gender expression that, you know, has been part of our culture, has been part of human, you know, civilization from the very beginning.
And of course, the story that you just told about the experience of the teachers reinforces that, you know, this doesn't come easy, and sometimes it comes with growing pains, but being able to persist through those growing pains, being able to grapple with your own discomfort in this kind of situation and you know, continue, really does lead to incredibly positive outcomes in the long run. So to expect that this is just going to be a walk in the park, I think may be setting yourself up for failure. But to say, you know, this may not be easy. This may kind of feel weird. And just like therapy, there's going to be moments where I am recognizing things about myself and where I'm having to really come to terms with things that aren't necessarily as savory as I thought. Ultimately, it leads to way more positive outcomes. It leads to a lot of really you know, important potentialities. And I think that's an important thing to recognize, because I could see that being a stumbling block for a lot of people, being like, this kind of hurts. I don't want to do this. You know, like, I don't want to recognize all the times when I've been a shitty person to other people, because that's not a good feeling. But that's part of the process.
It's such an important point. And especially, I think we need to really normalize and really extend the idea that mistakes are going to happen. You are going to, you know, in this journey, in this process, you are going to inevitably, you know, come up against uncomfortable, you know, realities about yourself, or, you know, inadvertently, you know, say something that now you realize is harmful, or, you know, possibly, you know, do the wrong thing in a situation and maybe have that pointed out. And that could feel really uncomfortable. And, you know, I think the really important thing, and this was something that was really emphasized to me by many of the researchers I spoke to, the really important thing in that moment is to stick with it, to not disengage. Because what is so common that happens is, this especially happens with white people who are on kind of an anti-racist journey, who are trying to figure out how to unlearn the toxic lies that we've learned about white supremacy. So something that that happens so frequently is that when those white folks make a mistake, it is so uncomfortable and they feel so ashamed that they disengage, that they don't go forward. And that is like such a missed opportunity, because that is the moment of learning. That is the moment of growth. And so if we can just stick with those moments of discomfort long enough to learn what we can learn and then move to the next step, we are going to get so much farther.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, Jessica, I feel like I've kept you already for too long. There's so many more things I could ask you. But of course, there's so many more things in the book. So I really do encourage everybody to pick up a copy of The End of Bias, A Beginning, The Science and Practice of Overcoming Unconscious Bias. Jessica, before we go, I was hoping I could ask you the same two questions that I close every episode of Talk Nerdy with, and they're sort of big picture questions. Are you ready to play ball?
Sure.
Awesome. Okay, so I want you to think about the future. And you can think about this in whatever context is meaningful for you. So it can have to do with the work, you know, that you did, that you've been doing on the book, but it can have to do with another project or something personal to you, something larger, really whatever context is relevant, think within that frame. So the first question is, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? Where are you finding pessimism, maybe even cynicism? Where are you finding yourself frustrated with potential outcomes? You know, just where are you struggling? And then on the flip side of that, so we end on a more positive note, where do you find hope? Where is your optimism coming from lately? You know, what is hopeful for you?
So this may be a bit disjointed because I don't know if I have articulated this exactly before, which is always the sign of a good question. what's keeping me up at night right now is that in Minneapolis, in my hometown, 2 years after the murder of George Floyd, we have not made significant changes in the way police are interacting with our community. And this is really troubling because there are so many things that we could have done by now and so many things that we can do. And I think the distrust between the police in Minneapolis and the community is so deep and so strong that it is very challenging to actually implement the things that we know will make a difference.
Yeah.
So that's incredibly, incredibly frustrating, maddening, and it's keeping me up at night.
Absolutely. And you are not the only one. I mean, how disheartening to see such tragedy and to know that out of tragedy could come positive change. Out of tragedy could come a wake-up call and a learning opportunity and has for so many people, yet the institutions are so resistant to that kind of change. It's definitely, like I said, it's disheartening. It's disappointing. Are you finding hope? And when you do find hope, does it have a similar, is it similar topically, or are you finding hope sort of in a different area?
You know, one of the areas that gives me hope, yeah, I mean, if we can stick with the sort of policing example for a moment, is that there are approaches that have been shown to change police behavior. And specifically, there's an approach that is being used in a small pocket of Watts in Los Angeles, where there's a pilot program where officers were given different incentives. So the incentive structure changed from making arrests to building relationships, and officers were in this program promoted on the basis of their ability to form relationships with community members rather than on the typical criteria that are used to make promotion decisions. And in this particular approach, over a period of time, research showed that officer behavior did change and that respect increased. Arrests decreased and violent crime also decreased. So there are approaches that where you can make a structural change, you can make a policy change, you can make a change in incentives that actually do create behavior change. The question is just, do we have the political will to actually put these solutions, you know, these evidence-based approaches actually into action.
Yeah, and I think that that is a fundamental perspective question for anybody who's grappling with feeling disheartened, for anybody who's grappling with feeling a little bit cynical when it comes to policing, when it comes to climate change, when it comes to vaccine sentiments, when it comes to kind of any large social geopolitical problem that we're facing. It's a place where I find hope, although it could be easy to look at it the other way, which is that we have super innovative solutions to these problems, and we have a lot of scientific evidence to show they work. And really, it's just a function of changing minds. It's just a function of will. And the good news is we know people can change their minds. We know that we can find motivation. We even have great social psychology to help lead this sort of cause for that. If many of these problems were so entrenched because we didn't have solutions to them, I might be more depressed. But I think knowing that solutions are right in front of us, and it's just a function of making sure that people want to affect change, that to me is a problem we can overcome. Ugh. Well, Jessica, it's been such a blast learning from you, chatting with you. I so appreciate the reporting that you've been doing, and I so appreciate all of the work that went into putting together this book. It's such an important book, and I hope that everybody has a chance to read it and has a chance to continue to personally grow, learn more about themselves, and continue on this really important journey that will ultimately have a positive benefit for all of society. So thank you once again for being here. It really was informative and a joy.
Thank you so much, Kara. It was really great to talk to you. And yes, I mean, I think only good comes from engaging with these problems and, you know, really taking the time to work on them. So I'm so thrilled that we were able to talk about it.
Me too. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week, for engaging in these really important conversations with us. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.